You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Little Strauss there, a little space travel. Space travel, think about it. It's so retro, so 2001.
3 weeks ago, the American spacecraft Discovery 1 left on its half-billion-mile voyage to Jupiter.
The crew of Discovery 1 consists of five men and one of the latest generation of the HAL 9000 computers. Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm sure that the entire world would join me in wishing you a safe and successful voyage.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
That movie, 2001, was actually made in 1968, before Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. But another Neil, though, has had it with the movies and the science fiction regarding space travel. With NASA grounded, the shuttle program scuttled, and no new human-piloted space endeavor on the calendar, our good friend Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, could use a few more science facts these days in the space travel department. His yearning is the main theme of his new book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier, and he's here in the studio with us. Fasten your seatbelt, upright locked position. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back. This is like my 80th time here. I'd love it here. Thanks for having me.
We're getting ready to launch. I think we're installing the engines on the building.
Or space,
we're
going to go into space. One of those things.
Exactly.
Plus that was Deodato 3001. That was his version of Strauss.
Right. Exactly.
I remember that from my college days.
There's so much in this book. I want to start at something that you remind me of. That's actually well into the book. The Apollo 8 mission, which didn't land on the moon, but was perhaps the signal event that will relate to if we ever do go to the other planets, being able to do what Apollo 8 did is really, that's what gets you in the door of real space travel.
Yeah,
remind us.
Apollo 8 is hardly remembered by the general public. I think people in the biz recognize its meaning and value. Apollo 8 was the first spacecraft to leave low Earth orbit and head for another destination. And that destination was the moon. It didn't land on the moon. It did a figure eight around it and returned. But that mission, upon going around the moon, is what produced that photo of Earthrise over the lunar landscape. And that photo is one of the most recognized photos of anything at any time in the history of the world. And it was the first time it's that photo that triggered the poetic reflections that we went to the moon to discover the moon, sure. However, upon getting there, what we really discovered was Earth. Earth without borders, without political boundaries, not Earth as drawn by map makers, Earth as drawn by the cosmos.
And of course, that movie 2001 is really about a Jupiter mission, but the physics of Apollo 8 is also the same physics that's required to get to Jupiter. The question really in order of magnitude between going to the moon and going to Jupiter is all about life support and whether you can get back or not.
Yeah, that's a good one. If you want to get back, that matters. And that's why over all these years we've been sending robots to the outer solar system, because they don't complain if you don't bring them back and you don't have to feed them. Sunlight works just fine. And we give them some nuclear pile and they'll live as long as you need them to, practically. So the 2001 film, while it said it showed humans going to Jupiter to investigate it, we've actually been to Jupiter. We've been there, done that. We did that before 2001, but we did it with robots. The real question going forward is, will we only ever think about the universe as a place to explore with robots, or will we be taking people along with us?
Who in the world is thinking seriously about human exploration of the planets? And let's just say NASA is maybe thinking seriously about it, but if you look at their budget, they're not doing anything.
Yeah,
seriously.
You can, talk is cheap, right? And so you can say whatever you want. For example, Obama, in his space speech a couple of years ago, said he wanted to continue on to Mars. And in so doing, leapfrog the moon, since we've already been there. And that actually received some applause because it was forward thinking, until you realize that it actually would require the layoffs of 10,000 people who are working on a vehicle that would get us to the moon, which would happen before you'd get to Mars. Also, the Mars trip would not be scheduled until the 2030s, which of course means that would be under the watch of a president to be named later on a budget not yet established. So I was a little disappointed that we now live in an era where a president can just make promises that they don't have to keep because it'll happen at some time later when, by the time, you know, Obama will be on the beaches
presidents
of...
make lots of promises that they don't...
Well, Kennedy, Kennedy did say, we will go to the moon before the decade is out. Now we're saying we will go to Mars sometime in this century, I guess, maybe.
And the before the decade is out would have happened basically under his watch had he lived a second term.
Right.
And had the Apollo 1 fire not delayed the program by 22 months, we would have landed on the moon under that promise. And so that's why there's a difference between then and now. So the space mission directive has to be deep within our culture for it to survive the fluctuations of economics and political winds.
You know, the other fascinating thing about this book here, and it's composed of a lot of your columns that you've done over a long period of time.
Yeah, it's every thought I've ever had about our past, present, and future. And so I even put tweets in there.
Wow,
that's good.
A quick one. Back when the last shuttle launched, the Atlantis, I was following the Twitterverse and that, and people were shedding a tear at the end of the shuttle. I said, no, that's not why you're shedding a tear. No. I think that's kind of audacious for me to say, to claim that I know the emotions of someone better than they do. I said, you're shedding a tear because there's not another launch vehicle on the adjacent launch pad ready to continue this adventure. No one shed a tear at the end of the Gemini program because the mighty Saturn V rocket was waiting to take us to the moon.
Oh, man.
So let's be honest with our emotions, get a reality check on this. The original title of this book was Failure to Launch, The Dreams and Delusions of Space Enthusiasts. Because in there, I just try to undo all of the fuzzy thinking that's prevailed.
The working title of this was I Want to Go, Damn It. And clearly, that's the mission and the passion here. Now, one of the things that comes out of this book, though, is that we've been conditioned to think that Mars is, that's incredibly hard. We did the moon, but Mars is so hard. You actually describe it in physics terms, in engineering terms, and even in financial terms. It's low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, exactly. It's relatively low-hanging fruit for many reasons, including the fact that, for example, if you go to Venus, we would vaporize.
Right.
That's
tough. That might be nice for a few seconds.
Yeah, a couple of seconds, you're good. Kiss it goodbye. So Mars would be sort of a natural extension of the next steps in space. But when I think of space, I don't want to think of space as singular destinations. I want to think of space as an entire backyard where if you need to go to an asteroid, you strap on that combination of boosters that'll get you there. If you want to go to Venus but not land but orbit it because you want to study the runaway greenhouse effect that is raging there because maybe you want to learn something about what's going on back here on Earth. Plus the asteroid, there's an asteroid with our name on it out there. I want to get a close look at what's going on there.
Well, let's stop you for a second. You're describing a capability that would essentially be a orbital-based launch facility that is flexible and could do a whole lot of different missions.
Precisely.
We got to get away from this, like, go to Mars, and then that goes in the Mars box.
Then you're there in the Mars box.
I see.
When you do that, okay, then you might go to some places for geopolitical reasons. You go to some places for scientific reasons. You go to some places for touristic reasons. And what happens is your vision goes beyond Earth's shores. And the point here, a big point I'm making in the book is there are many reasons to do this. I think the greatest driver is what impact it would have on our culture, our sense of dreaming about tomorrow, our sense of wanting to make tomorrow happen through the creative efforts of engineers and scientists.
What will be required of the culture to do Earth's first truly leave the Earth and go to the stars mission?
Stars or planets? Stars.
Just something so far away that basically they'd have to stay there for years.
That's a tough one, especially since the fastest spacecraft we have today, if I put you on it and sent you to the next star system, take about 50,000 years or plus or minus. So if I put you on it, you'd have to be accompanied by really fertile people.
We got 7 billion on the planet. We're doing all right in the fertility department.
So the star voyages are a little beyond our – consider also that the diameter across our galaxy is about 100,000 light years. Even if you could travel the speed of light, we would watch the people take that voyage and it would take 100,000 years. We'd long forgotten about you. So really, the only realistic dreams we should have is sort of regional exploration of the solar system.
And, Io, moons of Saturn.
Definitely. And Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, which has a liquid ocean beneath a frozen surface. There's a lot of cool destinations out there. Some you go to robotically, or you send people if the circumstances deserve it. And some of the circumstances, not always scientific. We have, our species has a history of exploring. And you explore vicariously through those who are on the frontier. And the motivation to explore historically has been war or the drive to increase your economic wealth. I submit to you that a healthy space program folds back into the attitudes of our country in a way that stimulates innovation. And it's innovation in the 21st century that guarantees our economic survival, because right now we're sliding backwards.
Who wants to explore the outer planets? Neil deGrasse Tyson, get your hand down. Astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, author of the new book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Thanks so much.
All right.
Which include all of his thoughts, he says, and even his tweets. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.